supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Restaurant owner Mike Weiss, who runs the popular gay bar Woody's and other Center City clubs, continued his testimony today in the criminal trial of Philadelphia District Attorney Seth Williams. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, how the jury sees Weiss will be important in the outcome of the 29 corruption-related charges that Williams is now fighting in court.
Jurors heard two images of Weiss. The first as a generous gift giver who regularly pays for friends' plane tickets, even if they happen to be politicians. The other image is a more conniving Weiss, a guy who bought 16 round-trip flights for Seth Williams, gave him cash loans and a 1997 Jaguar so he'd be owed things back, like being appointed as a special advisor in the DA's office. The image that is more compelling to the jury of 10 women and 2 men could play a major part in Williams' fate. The defense worked hard to show that Weiss and Williams are genuine friends. He once texted the DA, quote, "What does little Sethy want for his birthday?" Weiss also tapped Williams once to dress up as Santa Claus at an event for underprivileged kids. Defense lawyer Thomas Burke says, quote, "Did you ever call Seth and say, 'Yo, Seth, I gave you all these trips, make this happen'?" Weiss said no. He didn't expect anything in exchange for the gifts. Prosecutors said, "Really? You gave the DA cash and 16 round-trip plane tickets and you didn't think it was a bribe? Then what was it?" Weiss, who was under a court order to testify against Williams, said he was just acting as a friend. Bobby Allen, WHYY News.
A building in Philadelphia's Loft District, popular with the city's emerging artists, has been shut down due to a fire. The structure at 319 North 11th Street is informally known as the Vox Building, due to its anchor art gallery and performance space, Vox Populi. A small fire broke out in the stairwell last night, causing minor damage but no injuries. The city's Department of Licenses and Inspections has shuttered the building until further notice. It's home to several small galleries and artist spaces and has long been a hub of the city's underground art scene. It's not yet clear if or when they'll be allowed back inside. A multi-million dollar effort is underway to make the construction trades in Philadelphia more inclusive. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports that the city, a big developer, and a university are all part of the project.
Three programs are working within the same blueprint to make the unionized building trades more inclusive. Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney says the aim is to find positions for those who don't have post-secondary education.
We can help the young high school graduate who may not want to go to college but is ready to work and earn an honest living. And we can help our returning citizens who are trying to get their lives back on track.
Jerry Sweeney, whose Brandywine Realty Trust is sponsoring a neighborhood engagement initiative, says their goal is making sure work sites are more representative of the people who live in the city.
We designed this program with the hope that will open up doors of possibility for local businesses and create job opportunities for Philadelphia residents, particularly those who live in West Philadelphia.
Brandywine is pledging $5.6 million for its part of the project. The city wants to use the massive overhaul of parks and recreation centers for the same purpose. Wayne Miller of the Building Trades Council says they want to work together to help diversify the unions.
Sometimes it's difficult to change a culture that's been around for 50 years, but we're willing to do these things.
Ryan Boyer of the Laborers Union says the change is important for a city such as Philadelphia.
I don't think that we can overstate the magnitude of this moment, because what it says to me and the people in my neighborhood that the doors of opportunity are open.
Brandywine says its program could create thousands of construction jobs, but did not offer specifics for the number of new apprentices. Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
And this disclosure, Jerry Sweeney of Brandywine Realty Trust is a former chair of the WHYY Board of Directors. E-cigarette users report feeling less dependent and addicted than traditional smokers do. For WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Ann Hoffman reports that in spite of that recent study finding, researchers do not believe e-cigarettes are safer.
According to a recent study out of Penn State, people who use e-cigarettes don't feel the need to reach for their device as much as traditional smokers do. Researchers found that users reported waiting longer to use an e-cigarette after waking up than traditional tobacco smokers did. They analyzed data from people who exclusively smoked cigarettes and people who exclusively used e-cigarettes. Guodong Liu, the lead author on the study, thinks that could be happening for a few different reasons.
We believe the addiction is heavily associated with the nicotine level in the blood.
On average, e-cigarettes contain less nicotine than cigarettes. Liu says the study is about answering the Surgeon General's 2016 call to do more robust research on e-cigarettes. Assessing how addictive these products are is really step one. And just because these products are less addictive doesn't make them safer, he says.
E-cigarettes is complicated. It's causing harm, but not just from nicotine, but from other chemicals. And actually, it's not homogeneous. You never know what's inside between one brand and another brand.
Some adults use e-cigarettes to help them quit smoking, but Liu is concerned that e-cigarettes are appealing to young people on their own. Between 2013 and 2014, e-cigarette use among young adults more than doubled.
We don't believe tobacco companies just suddenly behave better and better and more passionate about the population health.
He believes e-cigarettes are just another delivery model for nicotine. In future studies, he and his team will test whether these young adult and teen users actually transition to smoking traditional cigarettes. Ann Hoffman for WHYY News.
Time's running short for New Jersey lawmakers to enact a new spending plan. Let's take stock of last-minute sticking points with John Reitmeier of NJSpotlight.com. John, thanks for joining us again on NewsWorks Tonight.
You're welcome. Happy to join you.
The budget committees in the Assembly and State voted last night to approve a $34.7 billion plan. What work remains to be done?
So the budget's made it through the committee process. It still has two more big hurdles before it can be signed into law. It has to pass the full Assembly and the full Senate, and that's likely to occur on Thursday. And then it has to win Governor Chris Christie's signature as well. And that would have to happen before the clock strikes Saturday morning. Based on our state constitution, New Jersey requires that a balanced budget be in place for the start of each fiscal year on July 1st.
Is this business as usual for New Jersey coming up against the deadline?
Sort of yes and no. I mean, the end of June in Trenton is always interesting, and there's always a lot of deal-making and a lot of back and forth going on. What makes it a little bit more interesting this year is this is Governor Christie's last budget. He's due to leave office in early January under our Constitution's term limits. And so this is the last Christie budget, and there are some changes that both sides are trying to make while they still have him in office.
Well, which way does that play? It being his final budget, is he more likely to hold tight to various positions that he's held dear, or is he more likely to collaborate?
I think that's the question that we're going to find out in the next couple of days. The Democrats who control the legislature have been playing ball with him on one issue that he wants as part of his legacy, which is transfer of the lottery into the public employee pension system. The pension system has been a big problem throughout Christie's tenure, and he's tried a number of different ways to shore it up with some limited success, and he sees this as one last effort to get what's known as the unfunded liability back under control. Another issue that he's trying to press in these final days is some regulatory changes involving Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield in New Jersey, and so far the legislature is giving him some resistance on that, specifically in the Assembly. So they're playing ball with him on the lottery and pension issue, and so far in the Assembly, they're not on the Horizon issue. What remains to be seen is if Christie would take a budget with the lottery issue, but without Horizon. If he doesn't, then we're in a showdown.
Also important to the Christie legacy is school funding, and I understand there have been compromises on both sides in that regard.
Yeah, and this is an example of the collaboration. The two legislative leaders in the Assembly and Senate, the Democrats have worked together to make some revisions to how the state distributes about $8 billion in aid to local school districts. Christie had some of his own ideas. It seems like they've worked out a compromise where they took the framework of the Democratic proposal, Christie made some tweaks to it, and now that's written into the budget bill that just passed. We talked about earlier in committee earlier this week. Question's going to be if Christie doesn't get everything he wants in other parts of the budget, if he then decides to take out any of these school funding changes, they're written by the Democrats, but again, with Christie's stamp on them now.
How exacting is the deadline? If the clock strikes midnight, does it guarantee a government shutdown, or are there various means to extend it?
They can go later than midnight if they're working on something. So if legislation's being drafted, they sort of stop the clock in that sense, and that's happened in the past. But we've also, and it happened most recently 10 years ago, we had a shutdown where anything that's deemed non-essential in New Jersey won't be open. State parks won't be open, state buildings, motor vehicles. And so you would see that. So the deadline is Friday night. Saturday morning would be when the first day of the shutdown. They have a little bit of a cushion because you probably wouldn't see the full effect of it until Monday, heading into the July 4th weekend. So they do have a little bit of wiggle room, but the deadline is midnight on Friday.
Well, I hope for you personally that it's not going to be a long night, July 1st.
I sure do, too.
John, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
You're welcome. Anytime.
John Reitmeier of NJSpotlight.com. And you're listening to NewsWorks Tonight on WHYY. The evening forecast, clouding up and then clearing overnight, falling back to 59 degrees. Tomorrow, sunny. Wednesday's high, 80. You're listening to NewsWorks Tonight on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Earlier this year, the rusty-patched bumblebee was added to the endangered species list. The plight of bees has received a lot of attention, and it's on the mind of local beekeepers, as WHYY's Mark Eichmann reports.
In a quiet corner of Newark, Ray Walker tends to his bees.
This is the pupal stage of the honeybee.
He monitors the bees, checks the temperature in the hive, watches for queen bees to produce more bees, and keeps an eye out for disease or parasites. Walker uses natural, traditional beekeeping methods to manage his collection of hives, called an apiary. He even uses native Delaware plants, including dried hop cones, to produce smoke to calm the bees down.
These are old-timey beekeeping practices that have kind of been lost over time.
A few puffs of smoke interrupts the chemical signals the bees use to communicate. It's a process that Walker, a former chemical engineer at DuPont, can relate to.
That's one of the things that fascinates me, is these naturally occurring compounds that biologically signal different messages to the bee colony. We need more pollen. We need more nectar. I think there's roughly 30 different messages that they use, so they have a very social structure.
Walker is one of more than 200 registered beekeepers in Delaware. Making sure all those hives are registered is part of Megan McConnell's job. She recently took on the role of state apiarist, a fancy word for the state's top beekeeper.
So the main goal of the state apiarist is kind of to work with the beekeepers throughout the state and make sure that we aren't getting any kind of new diseases that could come into our state.
She gave us an inside look at a pair of beehives set up at the Department of Agriculture's headquarters in Dover.
So the colony on the left is a nucleus colony that we bought about a month ago. And then the colony on the right is a swarm that we caught on the Delaware Memorial Bridge.
In addition to educating beekeepers and the public, McConnell also monitors bees being brought into Delaware to help farmers pollinating their plants.
We get a lot of bees that come from out of state, from Florida, Maryland, New Jersey, and West Virginia to pollinate our watermelons and cucurbits, pumpkins, pickles, things like that. We probably have about 3,000 colonies that come in or out of our state.
She's on the lookout for threats to the bee population, and there's no shortage of hazards, especially because so much bee habitat in Delaware has been paved over and urbanized.
We have a lot of things we have to worry about. We have pesticides, applying too much pesticides. We also have to worry about a lot of different diseases and parasites that are in the honeybee colonies. So we have a varroa mite. It's kind of like a little tick. It's the same size on a bee as it would be for a dinner plate on us, and it's sucking its blood and transferring different types of viruses.
Last winter, about 43% of Delaware's bee colonies died, a higher-than-normal number, according to the National Bee-Informed Partnership.
Yeah, we lose a lot of colonies in the winter from viruses and infections, bacteria and fungal infections. And that's part of beekeeping, is recognizing diseases.
To help improve the chances of survival for Delaware's bees, Megan McConnell suggests planting bee-friendly plants or vegetables around your home.
Any vegetables, squash, cucumbers, pumpkins, they're going to come visit, watermelons.
Some Delaware chicken farmers are taking steps to help out, too.
That is a goal with Delaware, that we are trying to get them to plant more pollinator-friendly buffers throughout their chicken areas.
With the help of the Delmarva Poultry Industry Group, chicken farmers are planting these buffers, which attract bees, but the plant roots also trap nutrients, which in turn help improve water quality. Every little step helps, and for keepers like Ray Walker, it's a fulfilling hobby.
It's a lot of physical work, so that discourages a lot of people that, work full time. There aren't that many hours in the day. But fortunately for us retired guys, it's a perfect fit.
From the Delaware Desk, Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.